Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin chapter, dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Some science fiction music to get us started on our next interview. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later, a new study finds that women are still underrepresented in the media today in areas like TV, film, and print.
First, science fiction has been a favorite sandbox for novelists and big thinkers for a long time. From Jules Verne to Margaret Atwood, science fiction explores ideas, history, and sometimes it gives us a glimpse of the future. Steve Paulson is the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, and he's joining us now to talk about the power of science fiction and something special TT Book has going on right now. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
It is always a pleasure to be here.
So you guys on To the Best of Our Knowledge have been thinking a lot about science fiction lately.
We have.
And it can be the kind of reading that people are a little more embarrassed about. You know, they hide the cover on the bus or whatever.
Right.
But geeks have come out of the closet in film and in fiction. So for those of us who love science fiction, can you make the case for why it's okay to love it?
Sure. Well, of course, it's science fiction is battling that image that a lot of genres deal with, which is, you know, it's not serious. You know, think, you know, it gets shelved in some special place in the bookstore because, you know, it's not part of literary fiction. But what has happened recently is a number of big name writers, literary writers, have come out and said, we love science fiction, and really this is one of the places where you can deal with some of the most serious, the biggest ideas out there. And one of them, for instance, is Junot Diaz, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, wrote the brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. Well, it turns out he's also a big science fiction fan. In fact, he teaches a science fiction class at MIT, and we did an interview with him recently where, you know, he was talking about why science fiction is one of the few genres where you can actually play out some of those really big philosophical ideas.
Well, I mean, how many literary novels do you know are about breeding people? Well, I'm a product of a couple hundred years of white folks breeding black folks to work. I mean, think about it. There's very few black folks in this hemisphere who aren't the product of this sinister experiment of breeding human beings. Now, this is not something that realism is capable really of addressing as well as the genres. Now, you look at realistic novels, the reality of the African diasporic experience is almost entirely absent. Yet you look at science fiction, and science fiction is always breeding people. Popular culture, what we call the genres, often are able to articulate in altered forms the hidden histories of our nations, the hidden history of our places.
And that was a clip of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Junot Diaz talking about why he loves science fiction. And that's what we're talking about right now with, to the best of our knowledge, is Steve Paulson, talking about all the opportunities that science fiction affords writers and the ways that it can help us explore big ideas and big themes and actually real science that could become
right.
plausible one day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's a whole genre of science fiction that's known as hard science fiction, and there's some debate about what exactly that is. But basically, the idea is that these are stories about science that's plausible. So, you know, forget about the transporter in Star Trek.
Wait, that's not plausible?
Not yet. I don't think so. Or, you know, there are all those stories about, you know, being able to travel to distant galaxies going faster than the speed of light. No, that is not plausible unless there is some science breakthrough. But there's this other tradition of what you might call very realistic scenarios in science fiction. One of the most famous writers is Kim Stanley Robinson. He did a series of novels back in the 1990s known as the Mars Trilogy, which won all the science fiction awards. And basically the premise was 100 scientists are sent off to colonize Mars. And so, I mean, think about it. This is a real thing that, you know, scientists talk about. I'm sure NASA scientists have talked about it. See, you know, we're not talking little green men or, you know, viruses that are going to, you know, wipe out all of civilization or evil galactic empires. No, this, you have to deal with rocket science, with geology, with biology, and all that it would take to create a sort of a livable habitat on another planet. And so he spells it out. And then, I mean, the other thing that's interesting is, you know, it's not just about the science. Then you get into the politics of it, because, you know, really what a lot of science fiction does is it's imagining what would a better world look like. I mean, that's sort of the underlying, the underpinning of so many of these stories. And so Kim Stanley Robinson plays that out. And, you know, it's not as if these scientists are any better people than the rest of us. But, you know, what happens when you get 100 smart people together to try to create a better society? And, you know, maybe it doesn't always go so well.
Interesting. That's not what I've read yet. And you also talked to someone else who is very literary, mm-hmm. but her writing often delves into these scenarios that, you know, could unfold should humanity bend a certain way, Margaret Atwood.
Right.
Can we talk about your interview with her?
Sure. Well, the revered Canadian writer who is famous for, you know, one of the most revered literary writers around. Well, she's also written this other strain of novels going back to The Handmaid's Tale, and she recently wrote this trilogy called the Oryx and Crake novels, and it sort of depicts a civilization that has collapsed as a result of kind of this global pandemic. And now she makes the distinction between what she calls speculative fiction, which she would describe herself as writing, and science fiction.
I say them as belonging to two different lineages, and those lineages began in the 19th century. And one lineage is descended from Jules Verne, who wrote things like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And he wrote about things that he thought were really about to come to pass and were really possible, such as submarines. And the other lineage devolves from H.G. Wells, particularly his early works, The War of the Worlds and The Time Machine. And here we are clearly dealing with things that are invented. So there are those two lines. One of them leads to things like Brave New World and 1984, and one of them leads to things like Star Trek.
And that was the writer Margaret Atwood talking about different strands of science fiction and how they developed.
Right. And so she would say, for instance, I mean, how do you classify a novel like George Orwell's 1984? You know, it's kind of futuristic. I mean, obviously written a long time ago, but, you know, it's not exactly science fiction. Now, she would say that falls within this tradition of speculative fiction, of something that could really happen. And of course, Orwell was really playing off of Stalinist Soviet Union at that time. And so, you know, the whole concept of Big Brother was very much rooted in the real world. And yet it was, in some ways, kind of a fantastic scenario.
And to the best of our knowledge, has been thinking a lot about this right now because you have an ongoing science fiction writing contest happening. What do we need to know about that?
We are very excited about this. So we, in partnership with two institutes on the UW campus, the Center for the Humanities and the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, we're putting together a flash fiction contest. So this is, I mean, basically the rules are fairly simple. These are stories that need to be between 500 and 600 words long. So short, basically about 3 minutes as you would read them. They all have to deal with this tradition of hard science fiction. So science fiction that's plausible, scientifically plausible, and the deadline is March 1st.
It's March 1st. That's coming up.
Right around the corner, yeah. And we've already gotten a couple of hundred submissions from around the country. And partly what's unique about this contest is we're going to have judges from all over the place, literary scholars, scientists will be judging some of these stories, and then we'll sort of winnow this down to the final 15 finalists. And then we have gotten Kim Stanley Robinson, who we were just talking about, the revered science fiction writer. He is going to make the final judgment. So he's going to take these 15 finalists and he's going to pick three winners. And then we are going to have the three winning stories adapted by Gates McFadden. You may remember her from Star Trek The Next Generation.
Of course I remember Gates McFadden, Dr. Crusher.
Absolutely,
right?
Yes. Okay. Well, it turns out she has a a literary, I mean, a theater company in L.A., and they have actors, and she's going to adapt these three stories for radio, and the winning stories will air on To the Best of Our Knowledge. So we are pretty excited about that.
Okay, so the deadline is March 1st, and where do we go if we want to hear more or to enter?
You go to the To the Best of Our Knowledge website. Easiest thing to do. You'll see all the rules there. So it's ttbook.org, very simple. And then also, the other thing that's kind of exciting is we're having a big event in Madison that will be kind of the culmination of this. So we're going to have a symposium where Kim Stanley Robinson is coming to Madison, and he's going to be on a panel talking with scientists and literary scholars, talking about sort of, you know, why science fiction is so great and how it can help us to imagine possible future worlds.
Wow, so you've got Kim Stanley Robinson, and you've got Gates McFadden and Dr. Crusher from Star Trek The Next Generation, so this is pretty much a slam dunk if you're a geek.
I think so. Yeah, we're pretty excited.
All right, excellent. Well, Steve, thank you so much for stopping by and telling us about it.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
And that was Steve Paulson, executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up, we'll hear why women don't get equal representation in the media. But first, we're asking you, what's your favorite science fiction book ever? Perhaps you have a favorite science fiction movie, a TV show? We'd like to hear about it. And why? What far-out idea blew your mind? You can call us and let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Steve Paulson was just in talking about some of the provocative ideas that science fiction can get at, and here's an example in this clip from Star Trek.
You realize what you have done?
Yes, I do. I've given you back the horrors of war. You can either wage it with real weapons, or you might consider an alternative. Put an end to it. Make peace.
There can be no peace. Don't you see? We've admitted it to ourselves. We're a killer species. It's instinctive. It's the same with you.
The instinct can be fought. We're human beings with the blood of a million savage years on our hands. But we can stop it. We can admit that we're killers, but we're not going to kill today. That's all it takes, knowing that we're not going to kill today.
And that, of course, is Captain Kirk from Star Trek. We're talking about science fiction right now, why we love it, and what some of our favorite science fiction books and movies and films are. And maybe there was a scenario that someone set up in one of those forms that just really blew your mind. It got you thinking about the way the world would unfold and about science and about different possibilities for life. And we've got a call right now. We've got Jeremy with us in Madison. Hi, Jeremy. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Great. That's an awesome program today.
Thank you. What do you think? What's your favorite sci-fi book or movie?
I really love the newest version of Battlestar Galactica that was out a few years ago.
That was the remake, right?
Yes, it was a remake of the original. I love the original as well, but the social constructs that they kept putting into the show and the different aspects they used to explain the current events that were going on, I think was outstanding.
All right, excellent. I haven't seen that one. I know lots of people are fans of Battlestar Galactica. That's something that was pretty big a while ago. Thank you so much for calling and sharing that one with us. And we're taking your phone calls right now of your favorite science fiction at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And in the meantime, we have producer Chris Molina with us, who is a big science fiction nerd, and he's here to talk about some of his favorites.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, Veronica. One of my all-time favorites, which I'm surprised we haven't heard about yet, is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is the famous, it started as a radio play, I believe. Not that I own the CD BBC recording or anything that I bought on Amazon a while back, but I'm a giant fan of the books. I kind of came late to that party. I know that a lot of people grew up with them, and just a couple of years back, I picked up the book with all five of the stories in them, and I read them all in like, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, and just a wonderful series, really funny, really well done. There's actually a sixth book not written by Douglas Adams. I believe it was written probably within the last 10 years or so, I think his estate commissioned an author to write the next book in the series, and I haven't actually read that one. I'm not sure how I feel about someone else taking the reins of the series. I'm a sci-fi fan, you know, true and true that, oh, if there's an imitator or someone else doing it, I can't do it. But
some people are purists. That's okay.
Yep, it's true. So, you know, maybe I'll check it out at some point, but I don't see myself being too excited about it at this point.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris. And we're going to go back to the phones and take Bruce, who's joining us from Watertown. Hi, Bruce.
Hello. One of my favorite movies is a movie called Gattaca that was made perhaps 10 years ago. It talks about genetic testing and genetic limitations that are put on. And again, it's set in the future, but it's eerily coincidental with genetic testing and things like that that are available today.
Okay, yeah, and that's sort of what Junot Diaz, I don't know if you heard the clip earlier, was talking about, one of those ideas that can be difficult to explore in fiction, but in science fiction, you can take it to different levels. And did you like the execution of Gattaca as well?
Exactly. In this particular movie, people are genetically tested to find out what they can do in society and different jobs and things like that. And so the main hero wants to be an astronaut, but he's not genetically qualified to do that. So he hides his DNA through a variety of techniques and eventually realizes his dream. And so the central thesis of the movie is that don't let genetic testing keep you down, that you can still explore your dreams and follow your bliss, things like that.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Bruce. That's not one I've seen. Thank you so much for calling and talking about that one. And we go next to Karen joining us in Milwaukee. Hey, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. I read a book series with my book club called Old Man's War by John Scalzi. And the concept of that was they took the spirit and the mind processes of old dying people and put them in young, strong bodies to go fight intergalactic wars. So the young bodies had the humanity and the wisdom of the old people, but the strength of the young people fighting a war. It was a real interesting concept.
Yeah, that is a really interesting premise. And was that an older book or a newer book?
Yeah, very old book.
Okay.
That somebody in the group had just said that they had enjoyed it once. And another odd, interesting sci-fi book I read was called Future Eden. I cannot remember the author, but the concept of that was about an alien chicken that had come to Earth to save the human race because we had destroyed our planet, starting by killing off all the mosquitoes, because we thought, why not get rid of these pesky mosquitoes? And when we did that, we also took out like 2 million human beings. But what is 2 million human beings to get rid of the pesky mosquito?
Wow, so this is a serious book, despite the fact of the alien chicken.
Yeah.
Right?
It was just very different and made you think about the things that we do as a human race.
Right, and that's sort of the point of science fiction, to get you thinking about the way different things could unfold and different trajectories that the human race is on. Karen, thank you so much for calling. Your recommendations, Old Man's War and Future Eden. And let's move on to Mike. Mike's joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, I saw it was a rerun of a Star Trek, the original Star Trek. I don't know what the episode was called, but in there were it touched on racism, and there was a group of people, and they were, half of their face was black, and then the left half was white, and then there was another group who were white black, and like the white blacks hated the black whites. They said they were inferior and all that stuff, and like when you're watching the show, you got mixed up who was who, but I thought it was fascinating. You know, obviously it was touching on the short-sightedness or the stupidity of racism.
That's so interesting, Mike. I just listened to a little bit from that very episode today, and it sounds like what it really did was, you know, took things from a fresh perspective and made you really think about how we think about race. Is that right, Mike?
Yes, I agree. That was back, I don't know when the original Star Trek was popular in the 60s and 70s, correct?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well, great. Well, thank you so much for calling in with that. That's exactly what we're getting in here. And let's go on to Nico, who's joining us in Green Bay. Hi, Nico.
Hi. The one I wanted to bring up is actually it's a series of video games that first came out on the Xbox series called Mass Effect. That's also spawned one animated movie and several books now. It really it kind of explores the idea that when humanity first reaches out into the depths of the stars, they find that there's already a thriving civilization of other races, and they're just the new kids that kind of nobody likes at that point.
So kind of turns, again, turning your feelings about being someone from planet Earth upside down, that you're the newcomer.
Yeah, and it takes from that, it explores the idea that with humanity coming in, they're more tolerated than anything, that when we come in, there's an extreme sense of xenophobia and just pretty much straight-up racism that a lot of people feel, while other people look to adapt and explore these new cultures that become available.
Well, Nico, thank you so much for calling up and sharing that with us. That was the video game Mass Effect. And that's all we have time for, but you can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Rob Ferret will be back next week. Coming up next, a new study says women are still underrepresented in the media and in everything from sports to film. More on that just ahead. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Rob Ferret will be back on Monday. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a new report says women are still severely underrepresented in media, from sports anchors to film directors.
And on our regular segment on Food Friday, we challenge some common wisdom about which wine to drink with fish.
But first, the Women's Media Center just issued the results of a study that shows that women are still largely underrepresented in media.
Kelly McBride is with us now to talk about the study. She's a senior faculty for ethics at the Poynter Institute and co-editor of the New Ethics of Journalism. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So according to the 2014 Status of Women in the U.S. Media Report just issued by the Women's Media Center, women are still grossly underrepresented in media. Can you give us an overall picture of what the study found?
Well, sure. The study found that particularly in management and in sports journalism, that women are horribly underrepresented. And interestingly enough, they come out of the colleges at a much higher rate than men. And that's true for almost all undergraduate degrees. But in journalism and communications, it's particularly true. They enter the profession at higher rates than men, and then they trail off as they go through the ranks.
So does that seem to indicate that maybe the reason that men are so much more prevalent in media is that these are older people, that they've been in the jobs longer, and that the women just haven't moved up yet?
No, this has been going on too long for that to be the case. Women surpassed men as the bulk of J school graduates too long ago, more than a generation ago. So it can't be that. This is a leadership problem in media.
What do you mean by a leadership problem?
So there's a lot of different reasons why women leave the profession, we haven't spent a lot of time in media companies trying to figure out what those are and trying to figure out how we could change that. And this is true of other professions as well. I mean, tech companies have similar problems, although they don't have the same pipeline of women coming into the profession that journalism does. So I guess they're maybe less culpable, but there's lots of reasons that women don't succeed. There seems to be a bias placed on male writers over female writers. I mean, look at some of the pinnacle publications that we have, like The New Yorker or Wired magazine. You see male bylines at a much greater rate than you see female bylines. Why is that? Well, we don't actually know the answer to that question. But there are all these benchmarks of success in media where women just underperform, and we don't know if it's because they're not getting the opportunity, because they aren't, because the way we judge them is unfair. We don't value the female contribution as much as the male contribution. So it's complicated.
It's interesting that it seems to be so true across the board, from the directors of films, the huge proportion of which are men directors, to a statistic like over a 3-month period, 82% of film reviews are written by men as well. Why is it so true, you know, just uniformly in general?
Right. I mean, book reviews are the same way. And if you look at the people who run newsrooms in the country, it's the same thing. Why is that so uniform? Because men are controlling the decisions about who gets to do those things, and it's not a priority for them to diversify. So they're choosing, you know, like if you are picking people to do film reviews, you're picking them based on the criteria that you have, and you're likely a man. So the criteria that you grew up with is going to reflect your own biases. And until you deliberately get out of that mindset, it becomes this self-reinforcing cycle.
Do the findings seem to show that women are losing ground, or that they're just treading water, holding steady?
You know, it really depends on how you slice it. But to the extent that, I mean, when you compare the number of people who graduate from journalism school or communications degrees, that number is becoming increasingly more female. So to the extent that is failing to represent in leadership positions in media, you could say that women are losing ground.
I want to look at one especially low point, and this is the field of sports journalism, with the vast majority of reporters and anchors still white and still male. And given the increasing numbers of women athletes and women fans, why this number here? Why has this changed?
So, I mean, this is particularly complicated because the world of sports journalism has exploded in terms of the people who are working in it. However, the audience in sports journalism, depending how you slice it, is predominantly male, particularly the audience that brings in a lot of revenue. So ESPN's audience is predominantly male, and when you look at how many hours people spend, not only is it more male, but men spend more time with ESPN products than women do. So that also tends to influence how they create their content and how they do their hiring. A lot of people in the sports journalism world are so hyper aware of this because they are topping out in their audience and they need to build new audience. Where's that audience going to come from? It's obviously going to come from the female population and the non-English speaking population. So the people who run sports companies, sports media companies, are super aware of this and they're trying to figure it out. But even then, they have this constant argument about, are women fans different? Do women fans just like good sports, or do they like female sports? And that's a legitimate conversation to have, and one that if you pick the first answer that women fans are the same and they just like good sports, you're still going to give them male sports because professional sports are predominantly male in our country. The WNBA is really the only successful professional female sports league. Has a fraction of the audience that the NBA has, and certainly a fraction of the revenue that the NBA has. The NFL and the Major League Baseball don't even have a female equivalent. So in those cases, the revenue and the money is still wrapped up in the male-dominated sports and the male-dominated audience. So it almost makes more sense that the sports world would be this way because that the sports media world would be this way because the sports world is this way. It makes less sense that that the rest of the media world would be this way.
Well, another troubling aspect of this report is the fact that the percentage of women of color in newspaper and magazine newsrooms has dropped overall. The fact that minorities continue to comprise only 12 to 13% of the newsroom staff. So what's going on there?
Well, in most newsrooms, the size of the staff has declined. Newsrooms have hit hard economic times over the last 5 years and have shrunk, some of them by up to 50%. And people of color have disproportionately taken that hit. Part of it is because people of color had overall less experience. The gains that had been made for people of color in newsrooms were relatively recent. And part of it is because newsrooms have less bandwidth to focus on the recruiting and the promotion and the training that you need to keep people of color. So if they can get another job at more money, they're going to do that because they're not getting the encouragement to stay on the jobs that they have.
So what are the effects of gender discrimination and unlevel playing field like this in the media? What does it do to the coverage that the world gets?
Well, ultimately, it affects the content. Because if you don't have diversity in the staff that creates the content, they're not going to think of the ideas. They're not going to contact the sources. You know, there have been other studies that show that the number of sources quoted in front page articles in the New York Times are predominantly male. Well, that's obviously related to the people who are creating the content. So it has these far-reaching effects. We don't discuss issues that might be important to people who are not white men. You don't see professional experts who are not white men quoted in stories. So it really plays out in this ripple effect to significant consequence to the entire society.
Kelly, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today.
You're welcome.
That was Kelly McBride, a senior faculty for ethics at the Poynter Institute. She's also co-editor of the recently released book called The New Ethics of Journalism.
Up next is Food Friday, where we'll bust some old taboos about fish and wine pairings. But first, Kristen Durst joins us from the newsroom with a look at these headlines.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. It's time for Food Friday, and this week we're challenging common wisdom about which wines go best with fish. Most people assume fish goes best with white wine, but this week we put that assumption to the test.
Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies, is here to talk about her experiment serving fish with red and white wine to see which pairing came out on top. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, so how did you first get this into your head that you wanted to challenge this assumption that red wine is what goes best with fish?
This was a couple of weeks ago during restaurant week in Madison, where we found ourselves with three entrees, elk, squash risotto, and then lobster with a garlic oil and green sauce. And we wanted just one bottle of wine for the table, and I wasn't sure we could find a red wine that would work with lobster, and we did. It was a lighter red from the upper part of Italy. And while I've had some really good red wine with fish dishes, that got me really thinking, okay, I know there's a reason why we mostly do white. The oil in fish can sometimes react very strongly with stronger red wines, especially tannic reds. It can sometimes taste like iron. But we're changing so much the way we cook with fish. We're using bigger, more robust fish, and we're using definitely more robust sauces. So I thought this was time to actually sit down and really do some serious taste testing as to what works.
And going back to why white wine has been the staple when it comes to consuming wine with fish, is that really, I mean, were people really thinking about the chemistry of it, or is it more about taste?
A lot of it, I think, has to do with where fish tends to fit in with, say, a big dinner. A lot of time up until, say, 20, 30 years ago, if you had fish, it was an early course in the meal, and you'd have, maybe a chicken or a steak or something to come afterwards. So you didn't do very much to the fish, and it would have been a lighter fish, so you would have had a lighter wine with it, just because you wouldn't want to get completely overstuffed and soused before your big entree came up.
Well, Lori, you, as our food guest, you always go above and beyond the call of duty. And this time you really went way out there and you set up a spectacular tasting menu for the Central Time team. And you paired four different cuts of fish, types of fish, and different wines. And I wonder if you could kind of talk us through that. Where did you start?
We started our tasting with a simple pan-seared fish. I'd tried it before with grouper. What I served the Central Time team was tilapia, but we served it two ways. Compound butter, which is, in this case, lemon, parsley, and capers, something that gets served fairly often, and also a red pepper pan sauce, something really simple that you throw into the pan after the fish has been seared to deglaze the pan and use the fish juices and pepper and a little bit of vinegar to make a really good sauce. And I thought it was interesting that the first time I tried this, we had different reactions around my table. And then to get the entire team together, very different reactions as to what worked better. We had two whites. One was a little sweeter than the other. And we had a lighter Pinot Noir, a California red. And, well, tell me what you thought.
I remember thinking that the taste had a lot to do with how the fish was dressed in a way,
yes.
Like what surrounded it. And with that one, by the end of the night, I have to say, I don't remember much. There was a lot of wine, but I do remember thinking that in most cases, both wines worked just fine.
Which is something that made me feel absolutely delighted. The idea that there is no wrong answer here. A lot of people will avoid fish because, I only drink red wine. I only like red wine. Well, we discovered throughout the course of our tasting that night that there are times and there are preparations where the red wine does seem to work better. That pepper pan sauce, I thought, worked beautifully with a red wine, whether it was tilapia or grouper. Now, I had some people tell me that it really needed the sweeter white, like a French Vouvre. And I had somebody at our tasting tell me that tilapia was just too mild a fish. If you were going to do a pepper pan sauce, you needed something that had a little more oomph to it. So right there, you've got, same preparation, but just the change in fish could change what wine you were drinking.
Mm. Well, you also had tilapia. You poached it in some lentils, and I remember that being really delicious. Why did you think that would work with red wine?
Because I love lentils with red wine. Lentils are one of my favorite things to cook in the winter. It's a wonderful, homey, earthy dish. And I was thinking, we've got lentils, and I've done successful dishes with red wine. If we were to add lentils and fish together, that's going to lighten the texture a little bit, but it may not lighten the taste. You've still got the layers of flavor with lentils, and then add the fish to it. And I had a feeling that that would be a good match for a lighter red. I thought so. What'd you guys think?
I agree with you. And I remember thinking, I wouldn't have even thought to put lentils in with fish. So leave it to Lori to be experimental and innovative.
I got that recipe from an old issue of Gourmet magazine from an article called Impress Your Guests. And I think that was one of the things to surprise people with. Yeah, who would think about putting lentils and fish together? But it worked really, really well.
Oh, I need that cookbook.
And, so
I was good to impress.
We also tried salmon with a soy maple glaze. Mm-hmm. And historically, I haven't cared for salmon much because to me, it's too fishy.
I'm the same way. Yeah. Mm.
And but you had us try it. I don't remember liking it. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. Now, salmon is a fish that I think for a lot of people is where they can really start experimenting with how is it served. One of the first times I ever had a salmon dish that I can still remember, and this was over 20 years ago, but it was served with currants, apricots, and almonds in a kind of a rice pilaf with cinnamon. I never would have thought of fish and cinnamon, but that was, I mean it, 20 years later, I can still remember how good that tasted. And I know I had that with a lighter French red, and it was amazing.
Well, I can give higher praise for it than Cynthia's. Don't remember not liking it. I thought it was delicious, and I'm also a hard sell when it comes to salmon. I don't think I have any kind of palate whatsoever when it comes to wine, but I remember everything we tried tasting delicious together with that fish.
Good. Good. I think most of us that night actually preferred the sweeter white wine with that. But again, if you're playing around, maybe serving a heftier side dish, you might want to think about a red.
There was one dish I remember where I thought the white wine definitely is a better compliment, and it might have been that one. One of the most exciting moments of the evening was the chance to try paella.
Paella, which I'd never heard of, but apparently, I mean, it's shown up as an ingredient on Iron Chef, and Anthony Bourdain loves it. This is a fish that you find in the Amazon, and it had been overfished, and it's now only available commercially because the Amazon is low oxygen water. This is a fish that can breathe water. It can grow up to 6 feet in length. It basically is all one tail. It's muscle. It's a big, sturdy fish, but the flesh tastes sweet. Now, I wanted something that we could blacken for this tasting. And when I was asking the fishmonger, okay, I've already got salmon. What do you have that I should blacken? He said, paella. And I said, what red wine would you pair with it? And he said, Cabernet Sauvignon. And I said something that I can't repeat on air. I didn't think a Cabernet, a big, hefty, eat with a steak Cabernet with fish. Are you crazy? And it was gorgeous.
Oh.
Absolutely amazing.
I left before that one, but I think that was the
crown
jewel. Yeah.
We served this with a Chilean red, which had a lot of herbs to it, but I actually went back the next day, got another fillet, blackened it, and served it with a California cab, and it was just as good.
Lots of memories and lots of delicious things to try, and I think people will be trying different things now. Lori, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it and for cooking for Central Time.
Absolutely. It was a lot of fun.
Lori Skelton is with us as part of Food Friday regularly here on this program.